James chapter 4, this morning we will look at verses 1 to 3 together, just a short little text, but one that is packed and very, very helpful to us. So James chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. As I look out across this room, I know that, again, we have many of our people gone, but as I look out across this room, I'm looking at husbands and wives who cannot remember the last time they've had even the slightest altercation, let alone a really good fight. And I'm looking at parents and teenagers who can't remember the last time that they butted heads or locked horns over something. And employees and employers who have perfect working relationships with everyone they go to work with. And brothers and sisters that live in perfect harmony, much to the delight of their parents. Isn't your home just a perfect, peaceful place? Families that have never had a family feud and friends that have never even had the slightest little thing come between them ever. That's what I see when I look at you and when you look at me. You're looking at a pastor who basically has the perfect, peaceful marriage and home. And who lives in perfect harmony with everyone around him. Okay, so who are we kidding? All of us know that's not true, even if we wish that it was. Conflict is a common part of all of our lives, my life included. At the end of chapter 3 of the book of James, James said that the wisdom from above is peaceable. In other words, it's peace-loving and peace-making. And then he says a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. We're supposed to have these lives that are full of peace and void of conflict. And instead, they seem to be full of conflict and void of peace. Why is that? And how do we fix that? Well, James wants to answer that question in our text today. And to summarize what James is, I think, getting at, he's more or less saying, if you treasure Christ supremely, peace will follow. You will have peace. So I want to go ahead and read this text, James chapter 4. Let's look at verses 1 to 3. James writes, "What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this? That your passions are at war within you. You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions." This text, when I read it, it sort of reminds me a little bit about how we might feel in preparation for a root canal. Like, this is going to really hurt. I don't really want to go through this, but I know this is going to be good for me. And this is one of those texts in Scripture where you look at it and you know if you pause it and look at it, it's going to be really, really painful. It's going to hurt. But at the same time, you know, this is going to be really, really good for me. I need this. And so we're going to look this morning at four hard-hitting truths about conflict. And they do hit hard. They're going to go straight to your heart. But so good, so helpful. So the first truth that we want to consider is that the root of conflict is idolatry. In verse 1, James begins by asking, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? James is just asking a simple question of source or origin. He's much like a spiritual pathologist of sorts. He's trying to help us pinpoint the exact source of the problem so that hopefully we can fix it. What is the source or cause of your conflict? With your spouse, or with your parents, or your boss, or with your coworker, or with your extended family, or with your fellow church member. What's the root cause of the conflict? If you could put your finger right on the very source of the problem, what is it? Well, pastors and counselors ask the same question that James asks here. They ask that question all the time. For example, it's not uncommon for a couple to reach out to me and say, Pastor, we are really struggling right now. There's a lot of conflict and there's a lot of tension in our marriage. And frankly, to be honest, it's been that way for a long time. And we've tried and tried to work through it. And we just can't ever seem to get over this hurdle. We're just stuck. And so I say, of course, I would love to sit down. I would love to meet with you. I mean, I always am. I always appreciate it when people ask if we can do those things. And so we sit down, and one of the first questions I ask, just to kind of get my bearings and figure out what's going on, is I ask something like this. What is going on? Tell me about the problem. Why are you fighting? And typically, but not always, she's going to point the finger at him, and he's going to point the finger at her. and both view the other person as the primary source of the problem. That could be said often in a marriage. That could be said in any of our other relationships with people. And to be honest, that's exactly what my wife and I tend to do when we have conflict. I tend to think all of our problems are my wife's fault. And her first thoughts are that they're probably my fault. And that's probably more accurate. But pointing the finger at another person is our hardwired MO. It's what we do. If other people would just change, we wouldn't have any conflict. If this person would just do this instead of that, or have this attitude instead of that attitude, or just listen to what I'm saying, all of our conflict would go away. Well, James is going to answer the question that he asked in verse 1 regarding the root cause of conflict. And here's what he says in the second half of verse 1. He says, is it not this? Here's the problem. Here's the source. That your passions are at war within you. Let's unpack what he says there a little bit. Your conflict is a personal issue. James says, your passions are at war within you. You keep pointing the finger at other people. You keep pointing the finger at the person you're in the argument with or the person you're always butting heads with. But God points the finger at you. God's saying you're fighting the wrong person. Instead of fighting other people, you need to fight yourself. If you're having trouble getting along with other people, and all of us do from time to time, the first place you need to look is at yourself. That's what James is saying. He's saying, start there. Start with you. Your conflict is a personal issue, and your conflict is a heart issue. James says, your passions are at war within you. Or as another translation says, within your members, the members of your body. James is saying that you have a heart problem, that all conflict, the source of all conflict, can be traced back to something inside of you, something in your heart. Your heart is the root of the problem. And so we ask a further question, well, in the middle of conflict, what is it that's going on in my heart? What is it that's going on the inside? Your conflict is a personal issue, it's a heart issue, and to drill down even further, all the way to the bottom of what's going on, your conflict is a hedonism issue. James says that your passions are at war within you. The root cause of your conflict are the warring passions within your heart. So if you want to resolve the external conflict, and James talks about that, the fighting and the quarrels, if you want to fix all that, then you got to fix the fight within, the conflict within. You got to win the war within. There's a war behind the war. The word translated passions there in verse 1 is the Greek word hedone. It may sound much like one of our English words. We get our English word hedonism from that word. What is hedonism? Hedonism is a philosophy that basically says that the chief goal of life, the highest end in life, is to gain pleasure. And so hedonism basically becomes a feverish search for one's own pleasures and gratifications. And all of us probably have a bent towards a bit of a hedonistic life. The passions in verse 1 are your desires for pleasure. Your heart craves pleasure, delight, enjoyment, pleasantness, and things that are agreeable to your taste. Whose heart doesn't crave that? Who doesn't want life to go nice for them? But here's the problem. Those things that I just mentioned quickly become, if you're not careful, your chief concern. They quickly end up being elevated actually to the goal and priority of your life. The top priority. And James vividly explains it this way. He says that your passions, they don't just sit idly by within you, do they? It's not just like you have these passions that are lying dormant within your heart. No, they pick up arms and they demand that they be satisfied. James says they are at war within you. Literally, James says your pleasures, your passions are soldiering or campaigning. That is, they're carrying out a war within you, demanding satisfaction. Your pleasures are fighting to be gratified. Why do you have conflict? James just laid it all out, put it all out on the table. You have conflict because you have a hedonistic heart. The root cause of your conflict is therefore idolatry. Self-gratification is your idol. You were made for God's pleasure and glory. God created you so that your top good, your top priority would be to bring God pleasure and honor and glory. And you've made the chief goal of your life the gratification of your own pleasures and your own passions. And what ends up happening is people end up existing for you. And God exists for you. Conflict at its root is a worship disorder. You have conflict because you're worshiping your idols instead of God. And we'll flesh that out more in a moment. The root of conflict is idolatry. Next time you find yourself in conflict, and you will, probably this week, you should start by looking within and asking, God, what is going on here? What needs dealt with here? Stop trying to win an argument. That becomes your top priority. I just need to persuade him or her. I need a win. Stop trying to do that and take a look inside. That's the battle you need to focus on winning. The battle going on within. Turn your time and attention there. By the way, with James, by telling you what the root cause of conflict is, God's essentially told you what it's not, which is really, really helpful. You might say something like this. I think I find myself saying things like this. You probably find yourself saying or thinking things like this. If we could just take a class in communication technique and iron out some of these problems. Or if we could just learn how to phrase our words a little bit nicer so that we don't offend each other so quickly. Or if we could just get more rest and reduce our stress in this house, conflict would just dissipate. Or if we could just spend more time enjoying our relationship for the good things that it has to offer. Well, all those things are very important. And in fact, God has a lot of things to say about those different realities. But they're not the root of the problem. God is very clear in verse 1. The root of conflict is idolatry. It's a worship disorder. And then he quickly turns our attention to a second hard-hitting truth. The road from idolatry to conflict is super short. It's super short. The road from idolatry to conflict is so, so short. In verse 2, James reduces that road from idolatry to conflict down to three simple steps. And his first step is idolatry, and the third is conflict. Meaning there's only one step. There's only one thing that needs to happen between those two things. The road from idolatry to conflict is so short. If there's idolatry in your heart, that means that conflict is probably right around the corner. All it's going to take is for your idol to get challenged. By the way, as James shows us this road of conflict in verse 2, it actually functions very much as proof for what he just said in verse 1. He just said in verse 1, basically the root problem with conflict is idolatry. Now let me prove that to you by just walking you down the road that this takes. Let's walk down the course of the path of conflict together. Verse 2, here's the road. He's going to lay it out in verse 2. He says, you desire, that's step one, and you do not have, step two, so you murder, step three. And in case you didn't get that, James says, let me repeat that again, let me reword that. You covet, step one, you cannot obtain, step two, so you fight and you quarrel, step three. It's pretty simple, James says. Let's just work through these steps slowly. Let's flesh them out a little bit. Step one, your desire goes unchecked. We would call that idolatry. Verse 2 says that you desire and you covet. What is it that you desire and covet? Well, what he talked about back in verse 1, your passions, your pleasures. You have these desires, these passions, these pleasures that you want to be gratified. And that those things, those passions and pleasures could be literally almost anything. Anything that makes you happy or brings you pleasure. In fact, they could be very, very good things. They could be moral things, things that please God. But what happens in verse 2, we see that those passions have gone unchecked. They've reached the status of idols, and now they're demanding that they be gratified. And that can go on in your heart and you not even realize it. You could have a pleasure, a passion, a desire, and it could be an idol territory and you don't even know yet. But guess when you're going to find out? When that idol gets challenged. When your idols are demanding gratification, And then something else happens. Step number two, your desire gets frustrated. First, desire goes unchecked, and then desire gets frustrated. Verse 2 says, you do not have, and you cannot obtain. You can't get what you desire. Your idol's not being handed to you. Someone's not providing for your idol, or someone's standing in the way of your idol. And it's basically like someone has taken your porcelain idol, this pleasure, this desire within your heart. It's like they've taken this porcelain idol, raised it above their head, and sent it smashing down to the ground into a million pieces. And now you are devastated and you are mad. What happens when you don't get what you want is extremely revealing. Just as a quick side note here, I think that James is highlighting for us the unfulfilling nature of an idolatrous life. You're forever beating your head against the wall. In these verses, James references this second step of frustrated desire four different times, in four different phrases. You see, in verse 2, he says, you do not have. And then in verse 2, he says, you cannot obtain. And then in verse 2, he says it again, you don't have. And then in verse 3, you do not receive. Isn't that frustrating? Isn't that unfulfilling? When an idol captures your heart, your life becomes so unfulfilling. So James is just walking us through down this road. And step number 1 is unchecked desire. Step number 2, frustrated desire. And step number 3, it's just right there. It's conflict. You have conflict. You don't get what you want. And verse 2 says, so you murder. So you fight and quarrel. You're basically saying, I want what I want, and I want it now. And if you stand in my way, it's going to be a problem. And now you're fighting. And now you're arguing. And now you're raising your voice. And now you just took a strip off of another person. Maybe your husband, maybe your wife, maybe your parent, maybe your coworker. And it just gets uglier and uglier and uglier. Now a mother and a son are going at it. And a husband and a wife are going at it. And a brother and sister are going at it. And it all started, James said, with an idol in your heart. I find James' choice of the word murder here very, very interesting. He says, you crave something, you don't get it, and now you murder. 1 John chapter 3, verse 15 says that everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. Proverbs 18, verse 21 says that death and life are in the power of the tongue. Your tongue has the power to kill people. So you could kill someone with hatred in your heart. You could kill someone with your words. And yet, in a broader sense, we could say that murder is a form of punishment. Especially as you look at this text. You desired something, you didn't get it, so you very intentionally took action. It's not like you accidentally killed somebody. He's talking about you're punishing people. And that's exactly what you'll probably do in step 3. You end up punishing others with a host of different tactics. We've all done it. Things like guilt trip and shame. You didn't give me my idol, and now I'm going to guilt you. I'm going to shame you and make you feel like a piece of dirt. Whining and complaining. Or, you know what, I'm just going to retreat. I'm just going to go cold. I'm just going to withdraw and step back and give you the silent treatment. Or sometimes it's things like violence and abuse that could be physical or verbal. The withholding of affection. No physical contact or intimacy, no eye contact or a critical spirit. What are you doing? You're punishing because you didn't get your idol. And again, that idol may have been good, but you elevated it to idol status instead of keeping it in its place. You didn't get it. And now look at how you're sinning. Maybe I could flesh this out with a way I think this could happen in my own home and my own life. Every November, A good friend and I go up to the Athabasca area. It's our one trip of the year typically to go rifle hunting. And I love it. We typically go for two nights, 3 days. Sometimes it's really nice weather. Other times it's freezing cold. But it's so nice. You get up there, it's like my phone doesn't even work there. You're just out there with a friend having a great time together. We start planning this trip typically months ahead of time. In the weeks leading up to that, you're getting all your gear together. You're making your plan. Something that could very easily happen in my life. That's a desire of mine. That's a passion of mine. And I think it's basically a neutral passion in and of itself. There's nothing wrong with it. That's a good thing. It's a fun thing. And I could get really, really excited about it. And something that could very easily happen in our home. We have 3 kids, 4 and under. Our house is a little crazy town, as many of you understand. Imagine that we've got our 3 kids. My wife is pregnant with number 4. Let's say she's 6 months along, 8 months along. And it gets down to a week before that trip. And my wife has said, Nate, I wanted you to go on this trip so bad. I know that you would really enjoy it. And I really just wanted to free you up so that you could go. But I feel awful. I'm in so much pain. I feel like every day when the kids go down for a nap, I need to lay down. I need to rest. If you go on this trip, I can't take care of the kids. I need you here. And she says, I really want you to go. But could you actually cancel your trip? And could you stay and could you help me? Well, what happens in that moment is going to be extremely revealing. As long as that passion has been kept in its proper place and my top priority is pleasing God, then hopefully what I'm thinking is, oh man, I would have really liked to go on this trip. But even more than that, I want to love God. I want to please God. I want to glorify God. And God, I know that you say in order for me to do that, then I need to dwell with my wife in an understanding way, and I need to care about her more than I care about myself. And I need to lovingly lead. And so I'm going to happily say, you know what, honey, I'd be happy to do that. And maybe it'll work out in a few weeks or next year or whatever the case may be. But there's also a very good chance in that moment that I'm not thinking that way. And I start saying, what do you mean? Like, you're getting around the house fine. You can take care of all the kids. Come on. Like, I need this. This is important. What, invite some friend to come stay at the house with you. I want to go on this trip. And I start giving her the gears. And I start saying this. And I start saying that. I'm not loving her. I'm punishing her. And next thing you know, we're in the middle of a conflict. The road from idolatry to conflict is so, so short. And if you have an idol in your heart, all it's going to take is for that to get challenged. And you will have conflict. James turns our attention to a third hard-hitting truth. The ruin of your fulfillment comes from God Himself. Look at verses 2 and 3. Actually, the second half of verse 2 down into verse 3. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. Okay, based on those verses that I just read, and you may need to keep looking at them for a moment, but based on those verses, who is it that, to go back to the further, the previous analogy that I used, who is it that takes this idol of yours, this porcelain, precious idol of yours, and raises it above his head and sends it crashing to the ground in a million pieces? Who is it, based on verses 2 and 3, who does that? Somebody does that. Who is it? Who is it that's frustrating your desire? But God says, you make no mistake about it. It's me. It's God. On the surface, it looks like the greatest obstacle to your desire is your husband or your wife or your coworker or your boss or your mom or your dad or your sibling or whoever else. But why does God say you don't have what you want? Because he refuses to give it to you. God says, listen, it's not him, it's not her, it's me. Do you remember Exodus chapter 20, the 10 commandments, command number 1, very first command God gives? God says, you shall have no other gods before me. God is in the business of challenging, exposing, and crushing your idols. He will not take second place in your life. He will not be reduced to that. Why does God withhold with satisfaction from you? Why doesn't God give you what you want? Well, there's probably a few reasons for that. We're given a couple in this text. God withholds satisfaction because you don't look to him. The end of verse 2 says, you don't have because you don't ask. Why does God frustrate your desires? Maybe it's because you're not looking to him as the greatest satisfier and fulfiller in your life. Every good gift comes from the hand of God. Idolatry manifests itself by the way that you talk to God. The Bible tells us that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. That's also true of how we speak to God. How does an idolatrous heart speak to God? Often it simply doesn't. Because it's so focused on its own heart desires and just going and pursuing those things, why would you need God? And yet every good gift, every good thing comes from Him. And somehow we leave Him out of that equation. An idolatrous heart may not even have use for God in the moment. But there's another possible reason why God might not give you what you want. God withholds satisfaction because you've degraded Him. Look at verse 3. You ask, and you do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. Idolatry displaces God and it degrades Him by turning Him basically into nothing more than your personal prayer genie. And He's not going to be put in that position by you. If you come to God with all the wrong motives and you say, God, I need this and I need this and I need this, and you just want to keep fulfilling your idols, God's not going to give you what you're asking for. I remember growing up watching Walt Disney's Aladdin, I think the original one, as a little boy. And you may recall that movie and remember what happens, that Aladdin finds this gold lamp and he takes it and he rubs it. And next thing you know, a bombastic genie pops out and offers to grant Aladdin basically whatever he wants. The genie only has three rules. He said, number one, I can't kill anybody, so don't ask me to do that. And number two, I can't make anybody fall in love with anybody else. And number three, I can't bring people back from the dead. Those are my only three rules. But anything you ask it, and it's yours. Wow. What an opportunity. The genie says, other than that, other than those three things, you got it. Ask whatever you want. Why is it that we come to God like that? Why is it that we come to God as if He's some sort of genie just there to give us our greatest desires and wishes? God's not your genie. He should be your supreme treasure. He's not there to give you all these treasures. He's there to be your treasure. And consequently, in being your treasure, it's a rich, wonderful, abundant life. But He wants first place. So the ruin of your fulfillment comes from God. And if you have idols, expect for God to crush them sooner or later, and pray as you're asking God and you're making your request. What God wants you to say, what He wants you to say, what He wants you to do is pray for His will to be done. God, I'd really, really like this. I would really enjoy this pleasure. If it's possible, could you provide that in my life? But if not, that's okay. God, I'm here to live for You. This is about You, not me. That's how God wants you to pray. And finally, our fourth hard-hitting truth about conflict. And this is something that, looking at these other three verses, it's a really simple conclusion. Fourth truth. The remedy to idolatry and conflict is worship. Isn't that the logical conclusion of all this? That the problem has come because you've elevated the obtaining of your passions to the chief goal of life? So in order to enthrone those passions in your heart, what did you have to do? In order to put your passions all the way up on the throne of your heart to the highest place, what did you have to do to put them there? You had to dethrone Christ and drag Him down from that elevated position. And I think what James is saying is, listen, there's got to be repentance and a great reversal. Those idols have to be pulled off the throne and Christ has to go back up there. In order to enthrone those passions in your heart, you had to dethrone Jesus as your supreme treasure. And now it's time to dethrone your idols and restore Jesus to His proper place as the supreme treasure of your heart. That's a battle, isn't it, in the Christian life? It's like He's up there and He's down, and He's up there and He's down, and He's up there and He's down. And yet the Christian life is this constant battle. It's this constant fight to keep Christ first, to keep Christ our supreme treasure. And any time we have conflict, it's probably showing us that He's not in that position. Conflict is a worship disorder that starts in the heart. So the remedy to idolatry and conflict is worship. You worship Christ. Treasure Christ supremely. And guess what will happen? Peace will follow. It will follow. That means you can have peace in your home. You can have peace in your marriage. What you're dealing with, the conflict that you're facing, is not this insurmountable obstacle. Peace is something that God wants you to have, and He can provide if you'll treasure Him above all things. I'd ask you, would you go ahead and bow with me at this time?